Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson, and you're listening to Mac Format This Week. We're taking a much-needed vacation for a few weeks, but we've got a great Best of Mac Format edition for you. We couldn't think of a better show than our 26th of May edition with Wall Street Journal technology columnist Walt Mossberg. You'll hear his in-depth thoughts on Apple and many of its products, along with some valuable tips on finding the best UK broadband company and Q&A with Trevor Middleton. Sit back and enjoy this Best of edition on Mac Format This Week. This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, part two of our interview with Walt Mossberg.
What makes the iPhone so important, regardless of how many it sells, is not how beautiful the hardware is, it's the software.
The Wall Street Journal's Walt Mossberg joins us for a rare interview and talks about everything Apple. Also coming up, how fast is your broadband?
There are a number of providers who deliver less than a third of the advertised speed. That's pretty shocking, really, when you're paying for services up to 8 meg.
Are you getting what you pay for from your UK broadband provider? We'll share some surprising test results and tell you what to look for in a broadband service. All that and more on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. If you read anything about high tech, the name Walt Mossberg is probably familiar to you. Since 1991, Mossberg has written his personal technology column for the Wall Street Journal, and he brings a sense of down-to-earth thinking and opinion few journalists possess. In part one of our interview in our last show, Mossberg spoke about his career, style, and ethics when it comes to writing his column. In part two, we focus solely on Apple, everything from Steve Jobs to the MacBook Air, and the iPhone, just to name a few. Joining us from Washington, D.C., here's part two of our interview with Wall Street Journal personal technology columnist Walt Mossberg. As you look back on Apple right now, where we are today, what was the biggest success that Apple has had, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's still the Mac, I would say the modern Mac, if you want to split. You know, I think there were sort of three very, very broad periods of development of the Macintosh computer. There was the original few years, which were when it was a sensation and it really did change the way computing worked. Then, as I said, they had this fallow period where they made a profusion of not very interesting models. And then there's the sort of second coming of Jobs starting in 97, when they have just done some wonderful things, particularly in software. I mean, OS X is the best consumer operating system, the best operating system, I think, on personal computers. They've managed to maintain that since 2001, and that's no small achievement. Now, obviously, you can't ignore the iPod, which is probably the single most successful branded digital consumer electronics device in history. The cell phone, taken in general, is, you know, all brands, all operating systems, all networks, is bigger, of course. But if you're thinking of one company, one product, the iPod is astonishing. I got to see the iPod, you know, prior to its release. And if you'd stopped me when I was walking out of Apple headquarters the day I had seen it, and of course it was under NDA, non-disclosure, and some Apple person had stopped me on the sidewalk as I was walking in my car, who also knew about it and said, you know, what did you think about it? I would have said, well, gee, it seems like it's a terrific product. They'll do pretty well with it. And if the person had said to me, in 5 years, will it still have whatever 70% of the market? I would have said, you're out of your mind. It's a consumer electronics product. It's going to be matched and you know, they'll probably have a respectable share. I don't know, 10 or 20% better than what they have on the Mac, but they're not going to dominate this for 5 years. But they have for more than 5 years. So they've done remarkably well with that. And now I think the iPhone is another breakthrough. It is literally a breakthrough product. And so all of these polls, which I don't participate in, where Apple is picked by various websites and magazines and so forth as the most innovative company, do make sense to me.
What was the biggest mistake Apple made?
Well, the biggest mistake they made probably as a company going back to the beginning was that they could not figure out a way to compete as a business. In other words, they were all caught up, and I think this was a characteristic of the founders period. They were all caught up in trying to make these cool, change the world, as they like to say, devices. But they paid too little attention to the business side, and so the company wasn't well managed, and they did not have a strategy for proliferating their platform, whether it would have been licensing or some other strategy, making lower cost models, whatever. They had no strategy for it. And to his everlasting credit, which, by the way, Steve Jobs gave him publicly at my tech conference when they appeared jointly last year, Bill Gates understood that standardizing on a platform, even if it wasn't quite as good as the Mac, and allowing a lower cost hardware to get out there would spread the thing to much larger numbers of people. You know, there exists a letter which I think has been reprinted in full in one or two of the books on Apple, that Gates wrote to Jobs, to John Sculley, who was the head of Apple after Jobs. And I think the mid-80s, in which he begged him to meet with all the other PC makers and consider licensing the operating system. And Gates himself had set up some appointments for Sculley or somebody from Apple to do this. Because at the time, Microsoft had an enormous business in Mac applications. Windows itself wasn't really, I think it might have been out by then, but it wasn't very successful. And Gates wanted to expand the Mac operating system as a platform dramatically so that his apps would sell into it.
Right.
And Apple just didn't do it. So I think that classically over time has been their by far their biggest mistake.
You can't talk about Apple and not talk about Steve Jobs. I mean, you know Steve Jobs probably a little better than most of those listening right now. How do you see Steve Jobs and the legacy that he's leaving with Apple and the technology industry?
Well, I don't think he's ready to leave his legacy. As far as I know, he's okay. But, you know, he is an extraordinary guy. I mean, he first of all, to have a second coming for a founder, it's not uncommon for founders to do brilliant things and then be kicked out after a while because they can't, you know, what the skills that make you a founder don't always make you someone who can run the company in an ongoing way.
Right.
It is uncommon for that to happen and then the founder to come back and revive the company. And that's pretty amazing. And I think he's a much better business guy now without having lost his zeal for doing a very bold, very innovative, high risk, gutsy products. So that's an unusual combination. And you've got to remember that until about a year ago, he was not only doing that at Apple, but he was doing it at Pixar. He was the CEO of a film studio,
right,
which was enormously successful. And he was doing both those things. So just as a business figure, he's been remarkable. But I think as a technologist, he has demonstrated an ability just to have a tremendous natural feel for what the consumer, and I say the consumer deliberately, would want even before the consumer knew she or he wanted it. And it isn't that he hasn't made the occasional mistake in a product, but by and large, he's got a string of successes from that kind of gut instinct that are historic.
Let me run you through some real quick questions here if I can. Analysts have called Apple's business, especially the Mac business, recession-proof. What do you think of this? Do you think it is?
I'm like I told you before, I don't go into the business innards of the companies whose products I review, but I used to be an economics reporter, and I don't believe any company is recession-proof. And I think if the recession that I believe we are in turns out to be global and significant, that Apple is likely to suffer along with everyone else. So no, I don't buy that. I don't think anything's recession-proof.
You love Mac OS X. I mean, that's very clear from your reviews. But what are the three things that you absolutely don't like about OS X that you would change or that you think needs to be different?
You know, I can't – there probably are more than three things I would change about it because nothing is perfect. But I can't, you know, come up with sort of a list for you off the top of my head. In the last iteration, the Leopard iteration, there are lots of good things. But I think the Stacks feature in the dock, which I won't take the time to go into, but I assume your listeners will know what that is, I find annoying and not particularly helpful even after they revised it. So I think that was a miss. There are a few other things. But in general, I think it's quite good.
So many of Apple's products have been ahead of their time, and some were a success while others were a flop, like the Cube. Some wonder if the MacBook Air is one of those products. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'll let my review of the MacBook Air stand. I sort of have 2 points of view about it, or three. I guess the positive is that it's gorgeous and that it's quite a feat to hit the 3-pound mark, which is the mark by which most people judge whether a laptop is a so-called sub notebook. To hit that weight without having to shrink down the keyboard and screen, below the level of what people would consider a standard laptop. So that's quite a feat.
Right.
On the other hand, I think there are too few. I think they needed to include more of the standard ports and connectors that people expect on the road, and that they made a deliberate decision to achieve the weight by making it and to have a thing of beauty by making it very thin with those tapered edges. They basically gave up the idea of having sides on the thing. And without sides, you can't put ports. So that's clearly a negative, and I believe it has held back. I don't know what the sales are, but I assume whatever the sales are, even if they announce it's a big success, they would certainly have sold more if they had more of the standard connectors. The other downside to it, which may be more important for a lot of people, is it doesn't have a lot of storage capacity. It has, as you know, the biggest hard disk you can get in it is 80 gigabytes. And I believe it was really designed. Ultimately, you're not going to see a hard disk in it at all. It's really designed to be a machine that uses solid state disk as its storage. But through no fault of Apple's, solid state disks today are extraordinarily expensive and have very limited capacity. Same is true of the ThinkPad X300, which is a similar form factor, not quite as light, but where they didn't even bother make a hard disk option, and they're limited to this 64 gigabyte SSD. So there, I think, unlike the other criticism I have of it, the storage thing, I think, will get better all over time. I would be very surprised if you didn't see a MacBook, and this is not, I want to stress, I have no inside information on this, but I do know that the suppliers of SSDs expect to have 128 gigabyte and 160 gigabyte models by the end of the year. So I have no doubt that Apple will eventually offer a MacBook Air with at least 128 gigabyte SSD. It will be still very expensive. So will Lenovo offer that, I think. And so the storage, and then as the price of that SSD comes down, then I think the storage complaint will go away. But right now, if you buy it and you have a lot of material, whether it's PowerPoint or Keynote slide decks, or whether it's music or video or photos or whatever, the Air really has to be a second computer. And there are a lot of people who don't want to travel with a second computer and have to kind of synchronize all their stuff. They want one laptop as their main computer, whether they're on the road or at home. And it's difficult. It's difficult when you have a top capacity of 80 gigabytes.
Right. Let's talk about the iPhone here real quickly. iPhone 2008. What's the bigger deal, 3G or iPhone 2.0?
Well, I think they're both. I mean, 3G is a huge, huge deal because you have even if they didn't do the SDK and the apps, which is what I think of primarily when I think of the 2.0 operating system. I mean, it will have some native new features. But even if they didn't do those things, they had to do 3G and they had to do it as fast as they could because they've developed. That what makes the iPhone so important, regardless of how many it sells, is not how beautiful the hardware is, and it's not how wonderful the marketing is or any of that, or the style cachet behind it. It's the software. And the biggest, coolest thing in that software is that they have a web browser, with the exception of its lack of support for Adobe Flash, is a real PC-grade, PC-type web browser. If you're going to be carrying the thing around in an environment where a lot of the time you're connected over a very slow cell phone network, it really undercuts the value of the whole thing. So they had to get to the point where they have a broadband cellular solution, broadband speed, which is what 3G is, and so if I have to pick, I pick 3G. I think of those two things, it's the most important. I have not seen it. I have no idea how well it will work as a 3G product. But, you know, whether it will compromise battery life unacceptably or whatever. But I'm most interested in that, yeah.
As we move forward and we see the iPhone and other devices get smaller and smaller, what's the one thing that you think about that really is the drawback to these types of devices that might be totally unable to overcome?
Well, they're not smaller and smaller because the iPhone is significantly bigger than something like a razor. And in fact, the trend that I am seeing as I am shown phones that have not yet hit the market but which are intended to compete with the iPhone is that the screens are getting bigger and therefore the phones are getting bigger. The drawback is a data input and data creation. Look, the iPhone, here's what's important about the iPhone. And again, it's software. They've managed to, at the very same time, take a PC-grade operating system for the first time and put it into a pocket handheld computer. Notice I'm not calling it a phone. It is a phone, but it's really a handheld computer. And then, on top of that, they've taken a blank sheet of paper and said, even though we have a PC-grade operating system under here, let's not do a PC-looking or a Mac-looking UI. Let's create a user interface that's appropriate for this phone. And I think that for a 1.0 effort, they've done a really good job at that. So that's amazing. Having said that, even though that allows you to use this in a lot of circumstances where formerly you had to use a laptop, it's not a laptop because data entry is just not as good as having a real full-blown keyboard. Neither the iPhone's on-screen keyboard, which I have no trouble typing on, nor a BlackBerry or Trio physical keyboard is the equal of a laptop keyboard. So the biggest drawback on these devices, I think, is data entry. And there's just a limitation to it. Could I write a column on my iPhone? Yes, I could. Would it be comfortable and easy, given that it's an on-screen keyboard? It doesn't have cut, copy, and paste. It doesn't really have a file system that's accessible to the user, so that you can save files and so forth. No, it would be hard. So to me, that's the biggest drawback.
And my final topic to you today is you're becoming very well known for another thing besides your column, and that's the D conference that you handle every year with industry leaders. I mean, your annual D conference is coming up later this month in Carlsbad, California. This is your sixth D conference where you bring together some of the industry's top executives to talk about the impact that technology has on our lives now and in the future. How did the D conference become reality?
Well, first of all, I don't do it alone. The D conference is jointly produced by me and my friend and colleague, Kara Swisher, who until recently was a journal columnist like me and who lives in San Francisco. And it happened just because we'd gone to a lot of other tech conferences and we thought a lot of them were boring because even though they had important speakers, these people were standing up and giving a kind of a canned pitch and showing PowerPoint decks, and you really weren't learning as much as you might have. And in the instances where people were doing unrehearsed interviews, people conducting the interviews too often were not good interviewers. And, you know, journalists aren't worth a lot for a lot of things, but if you're a decent journalist, you ought to be able to conduct a good interview. So we went to the editors at the journal, and we said, we have an idea to do a more journalistically structured conference where we would literally sit on stage and do Wall Street Journal type interviews that would be accessible to the people attending the conference and eventually to everybody on the web. And they bought it, and that's how it started. And luckily for us, the industry leaders and political leaders and media figures and people like that we've invited have, with very few exceptions, said yes and come and participated.
Who's on the lineup of guests for this year's D conference? Tell us about it.
Well, we have a somewhat unusual opening session, which will be a joint appearance of Steve Ballmer and Bill Gates. This will take place about 30 days before Gates leaves his day-to-day job at Microsoft for good. This is a transition they've been having, as you know, for a couple of years. It comes to its fruition, and D is going to be kind of the symbolic handoff. Obviously, Ballmer's been running the company day-to-day for a while, but this will be the symbolic handoff. They're going to talk about their relationship, growth of their relationship, and the future for Microsoft, and we're going to ask them all the questions you might expect, you know, about the challenges they face from Google and from Linux and from cloud computing and from Apple. So that's one big thing. We also have Michael Dell, who has never appeared at our conference, and who's going to talk about his efforts to revive and change the culture of his company. He's a guy who has had phenomenal success with a particular model and approach, and who now admits that they need to change some of those things. And so we're going to talk about how that's going. We have Mark Zuckerberg, the head of Facebook, who certainly has been a phenomenon. We have Howard Stringer, the CEO of Sony, who is in the interesting position of being both a tech company leader and also the leader of a media and content company. We have Barry Diller, who, as you know, is another media/internet tycoon. We have Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon. We have CEOs of TiVo and Time Warner, and just a whole array of tech and media figures. People can see the list of speakers at allthingsd.com on the D conference page. I should note, I'm not pitching for tickets here because we've been sold out since January and there really are no seats left. And then we'll do our usual thing of showing a few new products from smaller companies in between the big heavyweight speakers.
But no Steve Jobs this year. You've had Steve in the past, but not this year.
You know, he's been very, he doesn't like doing conferences and he doesn't do them. If you don't count Macworld, which is really a sort of rehearsed command control performance that he doesn't do other conferences. And we're very grateful that he's been willing to come four times to our conference, including last year where he appeared in a historic session jointly on stage with Bill Gates. But he's not coming this year, and it's partly has to do with scheduling. It's our dates and the dates for the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference are closer than they have usually been, and he told me that he's just got to be grinding, preparing for that.
Right.
We hope maybe we can get him back at some point in the future, along with some other folks we've had in the past who I think will remain relevant, like the leaders of Google and some others.
Walt, listen, thanks so much for your time today. You spent an enormous amount of time with us talking about so many different things. You're so well-respected in the community and also from this journalist myself. Thanks so much for joining us and taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brad.
Walt Mossberg writes about technology for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. You can check out Mossberg's column for free every week by clicking on our enhanced podcast link right now. So what are your thoughts on Walt Mossberg and his comments and his columns? Does his work help you better understand the Mac and technology? Email us at macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk and let us know. We'll share your thoughts on our next episode. Again, our email address is macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. A few weeks back, UK cable provider Virgin announced its plans to upgrade its broadband service from 10 megabits to as high as 50 megabits per second. On web forums, the announcement was met with lots of skepticism. Consumers wrote that they, quote, would believe it when they see it, unquote, and few said that they'd expect to ever see speeds even close to the maximum. How true that comment seems to be for the majority of broadband subscribers in the UK. According to a recently released study, UK broadband customers are getting just 48% of the download speeds advertised by their ISP. Broadband comparison site Broadband Expert tested 41,000 connections during February and March and compared the actual speed customers were achieving with the maximum speed quoted by their broadband package. The results were less than impressive, and they clearly show that providers are promising speeds far greater than they are capable of delivering, especially with top-end packages. So what are the results, and what can you do to better ensure you get what you pay for? I recently spoke to Richard Osborne, a spokesman for Broadband Expert in London. I want to go over some of the actual results from this study where you tested for over 41,000 broadband connections over February and March of this year, and you compared the actual speed customers were achieving against the maximum speed that they were quoted in the advertisements from these broadband packages. Tell us about the different speeds that people were getting versus what they were expecting.
Well, the headline figures are that UK consumers are receiving, on average, 48% of the advertised top speed, and that's based on all 41,000-plus broadband speed tests. There's also a massive difference between providers and between different broadband packages that those providers offer. What we're seeing is the technology is capable of delivering the lower broadband speeds, i.e. those advertised as up to 2 meg. In that particular bracket, we're seeing that the majority of people do achieve speeds close to that quoted 2 meg. So around 88% of the advertised speed is achieved. So the average speed of 2 meg users is 1.8 meg, i.e. not a long way short of that maximum speed. It's worth bearing in mind there's a number of issues that will stop you potentially achieving the top speed that are beyond the provider's control. So things like if there's a fault in the line, the distance you are from your local exchange, that i.e. the distance of the line delivering your broadband connection. There's also hardware and software limitations that can slow down your access. Some people may feel their connection's slow, but they might just be accessing a slow site. There is a lot that's within the provider's control, though. When we move up to the 8 meg category, which is one of the most common categories for broadband providers, we're seeing that people are achieving less than 50% of the advertised speed. So 8 meg users achieve an average only 43% of the advertised top broadband speed for that particular package.
43%. Wow, that is a major, major difference from what they should be expecting, right?
It's massive. They're achieving 3.4 meg as opposed to the 8 meg that is effectively on the packet. Same applies to the top-end users. So these are people who are paying a premium rate for a top-end service. So we looked at people with connections advertised at 16 meg or greater. Again, we're seeing that these people are achieving less than 50% of the advertised speed. In some instances, it's well below that. So again, there's a big disparity between providers. We're seeing that even the top providers, in this instance, UK Online, is delivering 62% of their quoted 16 meg top speed.
Let's talk about some of those providers, actually, in your results. Talk about some of the ones that actually were top performers and the ones that were the lowest performers.
In the up to 2 meg category, the top performers were Virgin Media's cable service. It's worth noting that this is a completely different service from Virgin Media's ADSL service, which didn't perform as well. UK Online, again, was a top performer in that particular category. And TalkTalk, which has received a lot of bad press over recent years, again achieved speeds of very close to the quoted 2 meg in that particular category. Even the lowest performers in that category, companies like Tiscali, Pipex and Toucan, achieved pretty decent speeds. Again, no one was far below, much below 70%. Of the quoted speed. So it's more of an issue in the higher end packages. In the 8 meg category, we're seeing that O2 and B achieve the top speeds. Both those companies use ADSL 2 plus technology. O2 are using B's technology, which is one of the reasons why they've been consistently good performers. Some of the lower end packages, or sorry, the lower end providers within that category, are achieving speeds as low as 26% of the advertised speed. And there's a number of providers who deliver less than a third of the advertised speed. So that's pretty shocking, really, when you're paying for a service that's up to 8 meg and you're achieving speeds of 2 or 3 meg.
BT, British Telecom, is the largest provider of broadband in the country right now. Where did they stand in this study in terms of their performance?
BT are pretty much mid-table. Within the 2 meg category, like most of the providers, they performed reasonably well. Their average speed was a shade over 1.9 meg. In the up to 8 meg category, their average speed was 3.4 meg. So although that's mid-table, although it's low, that's a category that most providers have performed poorly in. So BT do get quite a deal of bad press on some of the forums, but as you rightly say, they are the largest provider. So if there are problems, you're more likely to hear about problems with BT than you are with a smaller provider. So they're not at the top end, but they're certainly not at the bottom.
Richard, there are some things that the consumer has control over and some that they don't. And one of the things that they really don't have any control over is the distance from the exchange. So I would assume that probably a piece of advice you give consumers is where they're looking at broadband suppliers, that they check the distance that their house is from the local exchange, because that will affect speed. And there's nothing they nor the broadband provider can do about that.
That's absolutely correct, and it's also, it helps the consumer set an expectation of the sort of speeds they can achieve. If they're some distance from their exchange, it's unrealistic to expect the sort of speeds the ISPs are advertising. Unfortunately, it's a limitation of the current infrastructure.
So it's really important to read the fine print, is what you're saying.
Well, it is, and sites like Broadband Expert will allow you to check the distance you are from your exchange, and some sites will give you an indication of the sort of speed you might be able to achieve based on the distance from the exchange. There's other issues as well that are to some extent beyond the control of providers, such as how busy that exchange is. So if you're in an area with a very busy exchange with lots of broadband users, and in particular if there are lots of heavy broadband users, then that exchange has a lot more traffic to deal with, and it's not going to be capable of delivering the same sort of speeds as an exchange that only has a few people running through that particular exchange. So that's an issue that's going to affect people in perhaps busy areas where there's a lot of broadband uptake.
Now, you're talking about contention ratio here, right?
Yeah, contention ratio describes the maximum number of people that can share a particular line. The industry standard is that 50 other people can share that connection. That's not to say there'll always be 50, but that's the maximum. And if you're in an area where that maximum is regularly reached, then your broadband connection is going to be slower. However, some ISPs have a lower contention ratio. Some of the top performers in our survey have contention ratios of 33-1 or 20-1, effectively meaning that the maximum number of people who will ever be on the same connection is 20, which is clearly going to have a big impact on the speed achieved.
Now, Richard, when people call up a broadband company to talk to them, can they ask them about contention ratios, and will they actually get numbers from the provider?
Most providers operate on a 50-1, and most should tell you this if you ask. Not all the help desk staff are necessarily going to be knowledgeable enough to know that information, but it's certainly available on the net. I mean, it's easy enough to Google that information.
But if I were to call up a broadband supplier and say, what is my contention ratio for my neighborhood? They really couldn't tell me that down to my specific neighborhood as to how many people are sharing that connection, can they?
No, they're unlikely to know that. However, there's a limit that they can impose on the number of people who will share a particular connection. So they should be able to let you know if they operate the industry standard 50-1 or if they're operating on a lower contention ratio.
Okay, so ask about contention ratio, ask about the distance or find out about your distance from the exchange. Also ask them what? Do you have ADSL2, questions like that? What else can people ask to make sure they're getting a better service?
They're the main questions. It's also worth considering cable services. They're just run by Virgin Media at the moment, and they don't suffer some of the issues that ADSL suffer. It's certainly worth looking at the ADSL2 Plus providers, so people like BO2 UK Online.
Richard Osborne is a spokesman for Broadband Expert in London. You can check out broadband packages, test your broadband speed, calculate your usage, and read reviews from fellow users at their website, broadband-expert.co.uk. And if you're watching on your Mac right now via iTunes, we've included a direct link to their website via our enhanced podcast. So, are you getting great broadband service, or is it not what you were promised? Let us know your stories and thoughts on getting better broadband. Email us at macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. We'll share your thoughts on our next episode. Again, our email address is macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. On every Mac Format This Week, we answer your questions from iPod issues to Mac problems. Trevor Middleton is our regular answer man, and he joins us as usual to answer your questions. Trevor, thanks again for being with us.
No problem at all. What was that again? iPod?
iPod issues?
Bless you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you. That's a very old joke, my friend.
So
am
I.
We'll move right on with our questions. You can also send your questions to Trevor at machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And remember to tell us where you're from and also how to pronounce your name. Let's get right into question number one. It's from Chris Drew of Wilmslow, Great Britain. He writes us, I'm an American living in the UK, and I've recently bought a new MacBook. Unfortunately, I have a lot of old DVDs from America that I want to view on my laptop, as well as new DVDs I bought in this country. My problem is that on a Mac, the DVD drive is automatically locked to the region code of the first DVD it was used with. From then on, this can only be changed 4 times, preventing me from watching DVDs from both Region 1, the U.S., and Region 2, the European Union, at will. Is there any way I can work around this? Trevor.
Okay, well, Chris, the majority of DVD drives built into Macs nowadays are locked, as you describe, using something called Region Playback Control or RPC2 firmware. Once your drive is locked into playing DVDs from a certain territory, you can get it unlocked either by a dealer or by Apple themselves, but that, again, can be done only 4 times. Now, there are numerous hacks on the web, but they tend to work only with old drives that have RPC1 firmware, and you'll almost certainly invalidate your warranty. It'll probably be easier to buy a cheap DVD player that can be set up as a region-free drive.
Now, when you say a cheap DVD player, do you mean a cheap DVD player to use on my Mac or on my TV?
On your TV, there are lots of websites that tell you how to change the region encoding on the cheaper DVD players in particular, and it will give you a region-free DVD player, which means you can play DVDs at will from the European Union, Region 2, and from Region 1 as well.
All right, great. Our second mail is from Jason Anderson of Boston, Massachusetts, who writes, Trevor, I want to listen to local BBC radio stations, but I found some are restricted from being accessed outside the UK. A friend told me a way around this is to use a proxy server, but I'm really confused on how to do this and how it works. Can you tell me the best way to use a proxy server?
Okay, well, first of all, a proxy server is a server, a computer that sits between you and the internet, and it passes requests through it. A typical use is in a large organization, a school, a business, where there are lots of people on the internet, and all the requests for web pages pass through the proxy server. The proxy server has pages cached on it, and they load quicker, and if they're new requests, they're then passed on to the internet. The problem is, once you get to the internet, your IP address gives away where you are. And a lot of websites, such as CBS's, such as the BBC's, are targeted at specific territories. So if, say, you're in the US, you're fine watching, say, the latest episode of NCIS on the CBS website, but if you try from the UK, you can't do that because of copyright restrictions. So you can't actually do that because of the nature of the internet itself. It gives away where you are. Now, you can use an anonymizer service. There are various websites that will give you anonymous web browsing if you're really paranoid about who's seeing you doing what on the internet. But again, because they mask where you are, you don't get the content anyway. So the short answer, Jason, is give it a try, but don't hold your breath.
And our final mail is from Mark Streitfeld of Valencia, Spain, who wrote, I often get emails with attachments that end with winmail.dat. What are these and how do I open them?
Okay, well, this is another Microsoft's peculiar proprietary format question. Winmail.dat attachments essentially won't open on a Mac. The source of these files is Outlook or Outlook Express, which can generate an email message and attachments in a peculiar variant of rich text format, RTF, which Mac users are familiar with through Microsoft Word. However, this particular type of RTF is slightly different. It's based on a slightly different type of formatting and won't open on the Mac. Now, that's not a problem, because there are lots of programmers out there writing shareware and freeware applications, one of which is from TNEF, and it's called Enough. That's freeware. It will extract the file, and I will send you the URL to their website. Another one is OMIC, which costs around £15. Now, that will work with Apple's Mail as a plugin, and it will, again, convert those files into a readable format. I hope that's helpful to you.
And Trevor, we should tell people that OMIC, that's O-M as in Mary, I-C, is available at Mac Update and Version Tracker, the latest version, and it cost about £15. That's OMIC. All right, Trevor, thanks so much for your help this week. We'll see you again.
No problem. See you next time.
You can email Trevor with your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. And please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Walt Mossberg, Richard Osborne, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sekleropoulou. You can always send us your comments and suggestions to macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us again for our next edition on Monday, the 9th of June. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.